stretch your limbs for a moment. I wanted to give an opportunity for you to formulate your insights you may have had over the meal to this morning's topic, so that there was something left open, any strident breakthroughs or so would be nice to hear of it. Yes, please.
I would have just another question possibly to ask, not really an insight. I think one elementary part of teaching the growth is something which growth is something expanding and forward. I've got some difficulties in understanding it, where kind of letting go of yourself is kind of becoming something more neutral. I see that a little bit as a contradiction to that path or desire to become different or more, and kind of then how we are all here because possibly we are obsessed about ourselves, and possibly the people who stayed in bed this morning possibly don't have this question. So if we achieve this kind of peace and we kind of invite this stillness in us, my question would also be, what should come out of that? Sort of, is that in the basis to act sort of towards the outer world in terms of compassion, etc.?
Yeah, I there's a confession, you know, this growth thing. This is basically, Buddhists have taken to this with them. We've learned this from the marketing people. Yeah, they're obsessed with growth, and they have a very confused notion of growth. You know, economy growth is something that is perpetually increasing. You speak with biologists, then growth is not that way. You know, when you say growth, this is a stage of development. The next stage is decay. obviously, I think you know, the process you're referring to has many facets. One of them is, what do we create when we grow, rather than grow just in sort of simplistic terms? Increase my skills, increase my power, increase my competence, which would be the sort of economist's notion of growth. What actually is happening when we so-called grow? I think one of the things that happens is we create availability. And we, if you allow me to speak psychologically, we release contraction. My current understanding of self is it acts as a sort of contraction. It's a resultant force to pain. Much of my self construct is a contraction in the attempt to avoid pain. And it tragically malfires, because the more contraction occurs, the more likely I am to perpetuate suffering. So I can only learn to find forms of release, and a simplistic way is speaking of such release in terms of growth. If you look at Buddhist teachings, or the language of Buddhist teaching, it has a whole range of terms that speak of yielding, releasing into, undoing. Powerful terms that have only started to become meaningful for me in over the years. One of them is very little known. It's the title of my own center back home. It's called Atamaya. That's a very interesting concept, and it comes from a Vedic thought. That concept in Vedic tradition means tamaya, to become of such a nature, would be the literal translation. And it goes back to the thought of faith. If my hand grasps this clock and completely envelops this clock, yeah, then my hand will take the shape of that clock. if my mind focuses completely on the divine, then my mind will become divine by resembling the object of its content, resembling the object of its attention. Now there's something true in this, and the whole of Buddhist my training focuses, hinges around this. I can choose a skillful object for my attentional process, and when I manage to sustain my attention on that skillful object, the quality of that object starts to color the quality of my mind. Very simple, that's how whole meditation works. You focus your mind on something soothing, something rhythmical, something subtle like the breath. And gradually, your mind will start to take the climate of that soothing, rhythmical, and sensitive, sublime quality. Yeah? So the mind starts to resemble the things it associates with the help of attention. That's the linchpin of Buddhist mind training. I begin to resemble, or the mind begins to resemble the things it associates with. It keeps taking up, it keeps attending to. So that's one type of skill. And when I do that for a while, something happens that is subjectively felt as more spacious. A calm mind will decontract. It will become more open, more spacious. In that spacious and openness, things start to happen. Things like my chances to understand something are heightened, because a mind that is not preoccupied with managing sensory input or with managing my reactions to sensory input finds an openness. And in this openness, the capacity for understanding is dramatically increased. That's one of the reasons why people are encouraged to meditate. So I can't really say what has grown there. I could say maybe stillness has grown, or capacity for understanding has grown. But much of that growth is in fact a falling away of things that have made me contract. It doesn't really map very neatly with the metaphor of growth, you know, flourishing tree, blossoms, fruit, rich harvest, kind of. It doesn't quite map. It's like all metaphors, this metaphor doesn't hold complete truth. It is a metaphor, or more precisely, it is an analogy for a process that is quite pleasant. A still mind is more likely to be happy than an agitated mind. More happy is distinctly more happy than a wandering mind. Even though a wandering mind apparently has freedom to wander wherever it likes, the truth seems to be that we're not actually very happy if we wander around in the minds. While this may be useful and gives us some ideas, we don't actually seem to be terribly content when we wander around. We don't actually seem to be terribly creative when we wander around. We don't seem to be terribly whole when we wander around. Most of us would describe their wandering minds as being preoccupied with things that largely leave us either dissatisfied or agitated or in some form discontent. If I look like when my mind wanders, mostly it's wandering around and it is not actually coming back very happy. Yeah. Either it wanders around in things it feels deficient in and it wants and doesn't have, or it wanders around in fields it should get rid of and it still has. It wanders around in things it feels it should be due, or it might be responsible of, or at the end of it, some form of discontent. So one reason why Buddhist traditions feel that samatha practice is important is A, it's pleasant. It's a blameless way of experiencing pleasant experiences. B, it makes the mind more transparent, and as such it will understand better what actually is happening. That's the big reason why samatha practice is appreciated for insight meditation. And C, this is maybe less known, experiencing a mind that is capable of happiness through stillness and calm gives us, for the first time, a realistic chance to actually get a perspective on the sort of happiness we experience through sense gratification. Only when we have an alternative to happiness coming from sense gratification do we actually have a realistic chance to find happiness elsewhere than in sensory gratification. Does that make sense?
Yeah.
So one of the things, it's difficult to name the qualities that come from the stillness of mind. And growth would be a falling away of disturbance. Growth would be a falling away of preoccupation, of compulsiveness, of reactiveness. And the language of early Buddhist teaching particularly is not very affirmative. On the background of Vedic tradition, which is very, speaks in very fulsome term of the absolute, the one, the Brahman, Buddhists were very reticent to give affirmative statements to, say, the Buddhist notion of freedom. So they generally were speaking of this in negative terms. This isn't just a Buddhist idea. You have that in many religious traditions on the background of a very affirmative statements about religion. You generally have a strand of religious teaching that is practicing the via negativa, It's a reticence to speak of the highest in affirmative terms, because there is a knowledge that however perfect, however poetic your language, however comprehensive your model is, it's likely to name something transcendent in terms that are not transcendent. So early Buddhism falls into this category of religious teachings. You find it in Christianity, and in some parts of the Jewish tradition. The Indian traditions went through various stages, Vedantic tradition also somewhat reticent to speak about some things in highly affirmative terms. So growth, I would rate in terms of capacity to care, and your capacity to understand, and your capacity for availability, and your capacity to energize. Those would be all examples I would rate to be indicative of growth. Although they can manifest in different ways rather than being identifiable as a singular sort of nameable quality. In psychological terms, I would speak of higher adaptability, greater capacity to adapt, greater resilience, higher tolerance for disorganized phases in the patterns of experience, greater competence to create coherence in amidst apparently very diverse phenomena, skill in discerning large-scale patterns rather than getting lost in the minutiae of details and obsessed with them, either defending against them or getting off or preoccupied with them. We all do that, it's kind of what parents do when they're on the ball. They don't go and tell children how to play. They make sure that they have an environment in which play is possible. And maybe they give them things to play with, but they don't actually go in there and tell them how to play. They create the situation, offer time, invite friends, make sure things are safe, and then they're enabling rather than prescriptive in their approach. Mm-hmm. Does that make sense? Yeah. So I hope this is a kind of an answer.
Yeah, please. My question is more left over from yesterday's discussion. I hope that's okay.
Yeah. At the end, it's one discussion for me.
Oh, yeah. It's an interesting train you're following. At the end, you explained that you were involved in helping to train mindfulness to teachers.
Yeah.
I was hoping you could say something about the psychotherapy you offer and whether it actually involves meditation as part of the therapeutic process.
I don't connect this my statement about mindfulness teachers.
Well, I just, because my understanding that mindfulness teachers are central to it is the therapeutic process of practicing meditation. So I was just wondering, on a separate, what then triggered my question was thinking, you've explained you're a psychotherapist.
Yeah.
And I just wondered whether within the psychotherapy practice, which I don't know what that is, whether meditation forms part of the therapeutic process.
Yeah.
And whether you find you have to work differently with people that have an established meditation practice, or perhaps clients that don't meditate.
Well, let's try to disentangle a few things. Mindfulness practitioners are meditators.
Yeah.
There are different teaching institutions, but the one I'm involved in stipulates bluntly a personal meditative practice as a prerequisite. Not before even starting to train them. While training, it insists that they meditate. And after the training, it definitely encourages them to continue with a personal meditative practice. Not because that makes them more effective teachers, but because if they want to be teachers, they have to be basically walking their talk.
Yeah. My question was more whether that is then, in terms of your client.
Yeah, now let's. Mindfulness teachers are not necessarily therapists.
Mm.
While a number of therapists are mindfulness teachers, and there is some, you know, crossover there or some overlap. Mindfulness teachers don't need to be therapists. They're teaching generally within an 8-week context, a highly choreographed skill in very effective ways and didactically very honed, the mindfulness programs I come across. But they're not therapists, necessarily. They may be offering these trainings outside of a therapeutic context, outside of a clinical context for that matter. Then there are mindfulness-based psychotherapies which do a variety of things. Some of them just have therapists that are meditators. They don't teach meditation, they don't speak about Buddhism, they don't try to convince their clients to become Buddhists or meditators or mindfulness folks. They're just doing that themselves. For their own well-being, and that will have an impact on how they are therapists, even if they never mention the word meditation. I would hope, as therapists, they don't try to actually enforce meditative practice on their clients or foist it on them. So you have meditation or mindfulness practice as a personal path for a practitioner, whether or not he or she says something about this, whether or not the client is interested in this. So that's one thing. That, I think, is probably the most powerful transformative thing, that the practitioner is a meditator himself or herself.
Mm-hmm.
Then you have the situation in which a client actually invites the learning of meditative skills, then you may use meditative or mindfulness skills as intervention means in a therapeutic setting, upon mutual agreement, obviously. And then there may be a case that you have a meditator as a client, and you as a meditator, as a therapist, can refer to some of your own experience in this, and that will inform your work. All three things are possible, and all three things need not have anything to do with each other. There was a time I thought it is necessary that we establish a Buddhist psychotherapy, but I've come away from this thought. I'm not actually interested in Buddhist psychotherapy, although I happen to hold a degree in Buddhist psychotherapy. I don't actually think this is a very useful concept. It may sound quite okay, Buddhist psychotherapy. If you think of a Muslim psychotherapy, you probably get slightly nervous. Or a Christian psychotherapy or so. It doesn't make sense to think in these terms. I think Buddhist psychology has a lot to offer, because remember, Buddhism as a psychology is a lot bigger than Buddhist informed psychotherapy. Yeah. There's a psychology of mind at work there, which can inform quite in wholesome ways notions of mind and working with phenomena of mind. But I don't actually think that needs to be part of psychotherapy all too much. What is much more crucial and transformative, if you as a therapist know what you're doing, and if you have a contemplative practice, you will inevitably speak from the depth of that practice, and you will be there, you will model that, you will be present in different ways. Even if you do not mention the B word at all, or the M word, or that is probably the most powerful. That I do think it's important to have some idea of Buddhist psychology, some notions around the construction of mind, or rethinking some of our pathologizing models, and focusing psychology and psychotherapeutic work more on the basis of what is health, what is bringing contentment, where does healing come from, a client brings him or her in a better position to actually create meaning or find compassion. That, I think, is something one could learn from Buddhist psychology. That job, the translation of that, will happen to have individual workings. This will need individual works. And I believe that the most powerful work there is the personal, committed, contemplative approach in a therapist's life, irrespective of what the shingle says down at the door. I hope I respond to some of your questions. You could single that out. So you have mindfulness as a skill in a clinical setting. You have mindfulness as a personal skill of the practitioner, and you have mindfulness as something that you may use as an intervention technique in a client working with certain issues. Helping that client to embody some of those skills in his everyday life, for example. Yes, please.
What would be the objection you said you wouldn't want to use meditation techniques without the consent of the client. What would be the objection? Because you don't ask for permission to practice any other kind of therapeutic technique, like Freudian. I mean, client doesn't ask you how you were trained usually, or what techniques you're going to be using. What's the danger in paying attention to your body or to your breath?
No, I don't think it's the danger there. You do that anyway in some form. If you're doing that yourself, you're modeling that to your client. But somebody coming to me doesn't necessarily want to learn how to meditate. No. I am not a teacher there.
No,
I am called into relationship as a human being, and as a maybe psychotherapeutically called human being. I am not in the role of a teacher. I do not bequeath timeless teachings. I'm not handing out advice on a particular skill. He may never have invited me.
No, I didn't mean it in that way. I mean, I was trained to use those techniques as a therapist, as part of my training. So I don't see...
You don't see the danger in this? of surreptitious mindfulness practices.
It's not teaching meditation. I don't see it as teaching meditation. Yeah. I see it as having a bag of tools and using whatever you feel appropriate at the time.
We're having a misunderstanding. Obviously, I don't see any danger in this. I feel it is important that because somebody comes to me and I happen to have faith in contemplative practices and I happen to have a knowledge of Buddhist terminology, that somebody coming to me as a client does not necessarily need to take on my whole bag of convictions and of terminologies and of references. Yeah. So I think that's what I mean. No, I feel it's absolutely safe to engage, even to indulge in you know, surreptitious mindfulness practices when you're with them. You know, I think this is very useful. It's very powerful. You don't have to declare everything you're doing. Like therapists never declare everything they're doing. Yeah. When they start declaring, you have to become very suspicious. That means they're kind of generally camouflaging something. It's the Buddhist bit that I have difficulties with as part of a therapeutic process, because I'm not called into relationship as a Buddhist, but I'm called into relationship as a human being. Yeah. Yeah, please.
A little question I've attempted to ask teachers like yourself for some time. Coming from my own understanding, there's a vast difference between knowing something and seeing something from a personal experience. As, for example, there was an addiction that was almost killing me for years. I knew it was doing me wrong. I knew it was doing me wrong. But I didn't become free of it until I actually saw it. You know, this last word of difference. Now, the next question, you know, I'm interested in the thing the Buddha had. So I hear that he remembered an experience he had as a child, and he saw it with a certain clarity that was completely different to what he had learned from the ascetics. This was a personal experience. Now, my question is, it seems to be impossible to convey this. There's a kind of a uniqueness about this thing. I mean, you mentioned varieties of... you mentioned William James yesterday. And he wrote this book, this wonderful book, Varieties of Religious Experiences.
That's not the one I meant.
Well, I know. I know it's not the one you meant. But really what I'm saying is these experiences are so unique that, you know, a teacher might have something really, really, really transformative, but yet it seems impossible to actually convey this to another person. I mean, it's so valuable, you know. As just an individual, I sometimes try to convey this to a friend who's asking me a question related to it, and I find it impossible.
It's not impossible, but I think in its core, there is a magic there, isn't it, that takes place when somebody understands something. And you cannot produce this magic. You can maybe enable it, you can create a situation, you can hold up illustrations, you can use language, as you say. Your example of knowing, the difference between knowing and seeing. But these are, strictly speaking, these are metaphors. You know, the metaphor to see something makes use of the sense base, the visual sense, you know, your ocular relationship to the world. And the difference you make between knowing and seeing is certainly not a difference that you would find substantiated by the way the Buddha in his time was speaking. In fact, those two terms are used in exchange of each other. They're used synonymously. The standard phrase for realization in the Buddha's day, another metaphor, is knowing and seeing. Yeah. They're used in the same breath. But I know exactly what you mean. You refer to something I would, maybe you as well, you would call knowing about. You know? I have a sort of, in French it's very nice, between savoir and avoir connaissance. Yeah? This distinction is very clear here. Yeah? You know about something, doesn't necessarily mean you know it. Yeah? I've heard about it, doesn't necessarily mean you have understood it. Yeah? You know it exists, but you haven't actually brought yourself into congruency with it. This is a gap in the mind between, in that gap all of our learning takes place. It's the gap that says I have the cognitive knowledge of something and I have realization, I have connaissance of this profound experiential realization of it. Now all of our learning seems to be happening in that gap. We all know more than we have the power to live from. We all have insights we haven't translated into lived wisdom. And it takes a long time from knowing something. You described an addiction, knowing something that is not good for us, and yet we still do not have the strength to live from that knowledge. And it may take a lot more suffering and a lot more skill building before we're capable of translating that knowledge we already have. That is not false. Yeah. That is, we shouldn't be we shouldn't be down on this knowledge or invalidate this knowledge, and yet it is not matched by our strength to actually enact that knowledge. I believe that all our learning happens in that gap. Mine happens, and obviously there's one danger that we say, because I know it, I've already mastered it, which is conceit and inflation. And the other one, it says, well, I know it, but it doesn't work. It means my knowledge is worthless, which is equally unfortunate, because it actually invalidates something that is true, but I just don't yet have, it hasn't yet percolated down into that layer of my being that I need to touch before transformation takes place. And the struggle is how you hang in there with yourself, knowing things that you can't live. Willing to learn, willing to practice, willing to be patient, willing not to beat up yourself, and yet not betray your knowledge. Affirm that knowledge. For me, the most classic statement of this is St. Paul. You know, you will know that well, isn't it? Forgot where he exactly says, the things I know to be evil and I don't want to do, I keep finding myself doing them. And the things I want to... the opposite, basically. Sorry, can't quote it in King James, proper King James, but I bet you recognize.
I like to use the term testing, you know. Something has to be tested to be known. There's a fruit where I come from which has practically disappeared now. I can describe it to you. The tree, the fruit itself, how it ripens. But you won't know it like me, who has actually tasted it. I think it's a bit like that.
You're using another metaphor again, isn't it? The first one was seeing, the ocular sense. The second one... it's tasting, yeah. And that's maybe quite telling, isn't it? These two senses as metaphors for these two types of knowledge. We can see something without really knowing it, but when we have tasted it, then it means we have ingested it. We have a much more embodied and immediate quality of experience. Yeah.
Because I spent quite a few years with people who suffer from addiction, okay? There are brilliant people, and yet they can't actually, they know what's happening to them. And yet, you know, the puzzling thing of it. And in fact, there's going to be brilliant teachers who were obviously had an addiction, which they couldn't actually get rid of. I won't give any names in case...
Oh, the list would be long. There could be many names. Yeah? Well, look, it's what allows the human heart to let go of something is not immediately controllable. You don't need to be addicted to a drug to recognize addiction. Addiction is nothing more than a powerfully ingrained habit, a powerfully carved neural pathway. But any habit holds the potential for the degrees of unfreedom we attribute to addiction. We have singled out a couple of things about addiction, you know, food, drugs, work, yeah. But we can get addicted to all kinds of things. We can get addicted to self-use. All the stuff you mentioned this morning, yeah, particularly the views, can be powerful addictions. We can get addicted to anxiety. We can get addicted to stress. Addicted to systematically diminish the quality of our experience. Everything we keep doing holds the potential for addiction. Our society is very judgmental about certain forms of it, yeah, and highly tolerant of other forms of it. So that doesn't say much about awakening, it just says something about the values in our society. You can work yourself to death, and this is a quite okay thing to do. Nobody will stop you from doing this. You know, if you don't have a partner who tries to instill some sanity, you may happily kill yourself by working. If society will not stop you. You won't get put in jail for it. You may even be praised. The Japanese have a word for death through overwork. Other forms of addiction, if you have, if you have an addiction of, say, cat killing or so, you will very quickly get into trouble with your cat-loving neighbors. You have huge amounts of people who will be on your tail trying to have you locked up and declared insane and punished bitterly. So, neurologically, this mind is highly... There's a huge plasticity. That would be the psyche, the cognitive science way of speaking. In terms of Buddhism, say, this mind is habit-forming. You can affirm particular sankharas and you will form a habit. Some of these habits are wholesome and they will have, as a consequence, greater degrees of happiness, greater degrees of harmony in your life, greater relational and social competence. And some habits will make you more dependent. And they will take you into forms of unfreedom. They will make your life become smaller, more contracted, and more painful. You will lose freedom. You will lose relationship. You will lose the stuff that we know we have a better chance of making us happy. The magic lies in affirming that which we know helps, even though the problem seems to go away only very gradually. Sometimes the progress is dramatic when something big happens and we can break free from a habit. Sometimes the progress is very gradual. And the challenge seems to be that subjectively it feels I keep being confronted with something that's bigger than me. The knowledge I have is not powerful enough to break free. The habit seems to be stronger than my understanding, my goodwill, my faith, my... There are no easy answers there. But people with addiction have found ways of freedom. They have found ways of asserting their relationship, for example. Notice that they're not in addiction when they're there. Or admitting their addiction leaves them in a better position to be with their addiction than pretending it's not there, and then it takes them in full swing.
There's something in these questions about knowing, like accumulating knowledge, and the teacher and the pupil, where the teacher knows and the pupil doesn't. There's a kind of asymmetry, whereas in fact at some level they both know, and that part of the process of, well, I suppose vipassana is unknowing. It's
also, I'm not sure, you know, I wouldn't use the term knowing for accumulating knowledge. You know, knowing and knowledge are very different things in my books. Knowledge is quantifiable. Knowledge is, knowing is not.
They're the same root, don't they? Knowing.
But knowledge is something you can amass. It doesn't say tell you much about existential depth. It doesn't tell you much about actually understanding. It just makes, it just says, I have conceptual knowledge about this. I have lots of conceptual knowledge. I have encyclopedic conceptual knowledge of this. But knowing is a statement of depth.
That's the knowledge and understanding. The savoir connaissance is that disrupts the distinction.
But the connaissance is not quantifiable. It has another degree, maybe hardness or maybe depth, or it's not quantifiable in the same way as knowledge. Are we not on the same page?
No, I think we are. I wasn't making a case for knowledge, or even, I suppose I was thinking about the notion of unknowing. You know, is a path towards wisdom or something, a direct perception.
Yeah. Well, you're likely to know that the Buddhist notion of transformative understanding is threefold. It speaks of a type of knowledge that is, we would call information, data. It is called Suttamaya Panya. It's information made on the basis of what can be heard, what can be picked up, what can be inferred. Or strictly speaking, just what could be picked up. Just sheer information. That's highly praised by the Buddha. And then, though this is important, it is not at all liberative. The second one would be the capacity to correlate such information and data into meaningful patterns. That's where inference would come in, as a skill in aggregating data and information. Correlating, inferring, measuring, discerning, this kind of thing. So that second type, called a wisdom that comes from thinking at its best, is very, very praised by the Buddha. He says, you know, greatly appreciate people who know how to understand and discern things. He has many, many terms for this. But still, it's not actually liberating the heart. So the wisdom that he deems is the only wisdom that liberates the heart is the wisdom that comes from meditative deepening. What he calls bhavanamaya panya, which is a type of understanding that I would call knowing, that comes from skill in gaining contemplative depth. Like, you know, we all have some of that. We know certain things and we don't cry because these things are different. You don't stand on the banks of the Thames and wish it would flow backwards. We all know it cannot other than flow the way it flows. It cannot flow otherwise. It would be foolish to assume it could flow otherwise. We know about gravity. We have no investment in reversing gravity through our willpower or things like that. You know? We have completely brought ourselves into congruency with this. But there are other things we're not quite so congruent with empirical reality. You know? We think other people get older, we don't. You know? We know that we get older, but we somehow, it doesn't feel that way, doesn't it? the things I care about, they still seem to be here, and I am being surprised at that. People tell me I've aged as well, because I conveniently have forgotten this fact, and bathed in my eternal youth, maybe, so just in displacing the fact that not just they have gotten older, but me, presumably. You look at the old classmates for your reunion and think, oh God, look at them. What has happened to them? You know? And you conveniently forget for a moment, maybe, that something of that nature has happened to you. So it's a kind of, it's a knowledge that doesn't quite reach the bone. You know? And meditative depth is that which helps your knowing to reach the bone, to reach the marrow of the bone.
You've sort of helped us become more aware of how permeable the self is, really, but what's the sort of model in Buddhist psychology for how ethical actions emanate and change the self? Because it's presumably a sort of reciprocal.
Well, the magic ingredient is happiness. Mm-hmm. Buddhists are quite blatant about that. If you live an ethical life, your chances of being happy are gravely heightened. So if you just selfishly want to be a happy person, your best chances are you live an ethical life. You stop abusing, terrorizing others, you stop hurting others, you stop exploiting others. Because obviously if you do that, particularly if you do that on a regular basis, you would expect others to do that to you. And that would put you on edge most of the time. That would make you suspect that what you keep doing to others is normal, and you would expect others to do that to you, which would make you mistrustful and anxious and controlling and manipulative and so forth, which in turn would diminish your capacity to trust, to appreciate, to enjoy, to feel safe, to, you know, all this. So one of the reasons for ethics in Buddhism is your own wish to be happy. Another reason for ethics is that you actually acknowledge that there isn't really a happiness for you unless the people you're connected with, and the more you become aware of how such connection works, the more you realize that you're connected with many, many, many beings, with that planet, you know, with the biosphere of this planet, and that your happiness is strongly dependent on the happiness of creatures and beings around you, the happiness of societies, and that you cannot be a complete island unto yourself. And that suddenly makes you more caring. It makes you more relationally aware. It makes you more willing to support sanity and health in where you are, in your family, your clan, your society, your country, your... The biosphere that you take for granted and that is the basis for all our life, you know, that little thin bubble that has made life possible on this planet, which is a lot more delicate than we've all grown up to believe it is. We just assumed, well, it's there, it's probably been there all the time, it's probably going to be there all the time, and we know. It's not the case. It hasn't been there all the time. And if we continue that way, as we're about to behave, or as we're still behaving, it's not going to be, no guarantees that it's going to stay there. Stay habitable for creatures like us. Something will survive. I wonder whether nature is going to repeat the favoring those dangerous, unfeathered bipeds. Yeah. Maybe ants are more behaved on this planet, so more safe to have for this planet. The next experiment goes with ants, or rather than higher vertebrates. That's the magic of Buddhist teaching. Do you have at the core of a process of dependent arising, even a personality notion of dependent arising, and connecting this teaching with an ethical framework. Considering that responsibility comes in through intention and action, and that the retribution of this action, or that the result, the consequence of these actions, are a continuation of the intention that carries these actions through. I think that's what I rate him for, a great ingenuity. It would have been easy to turn this teaching into a nihilist sort of doctrine. And yet he found very convincing ways to outline to us that by looking after others, we're also looking after us. And by looking after us, we learn to look after others. It's no secret that we are what we are through the existence of other human beings. Most of our skills that make us human are skills we have learned from other beings. You know, the big stuff like empathy, mindfulness, speech and language, you know, all the stuff we don't develop alone. Nobody learns how to speak alone. Nobody learns empathy. You need people to do that to you. You need people to model that for you. You need people to help you when you try to start doing this. And you need people to continue doing this, to stay in training. That holds true for language, it holds true for empathy, it holds true for mindfulness. It's not something you can learn in a vacuum. So, since you have to deal with others, and since you reach your own humanity only with others, it is incumbent on our relationships that we make them ethical. Because if they are unethical, chances for happiness decrease dramatically, chances for harmony decrease dramatically, chances for learning, chances for development. We are where we are on this planet because of empathy. There is no secret about this. Empathy is the basis for being together with each other. And if your survival hinges on a clan or a gang of foraging primates, then empathy is the basis by which you find out what's happening with others. If you don't bother finding out with others, that is your clan. You know, you're not having the safety of a group. So empathy was what made it possible for us to actually develop. It's squarely empathy that made, say, brain development possible. The social stability of a group that is big enough to look after pregnant women who can't run away anymore as fast, who look after old people who are not as fit in fighting and running anymore as the young. And if you can look after the old ones, you suddenly have another generation of knowledge that can be passed on to your young. Yeah, that really is an evolutionary advantage. If granny and granddad are part of this evolutionary project of bringing up your kids, that is a real evolutionary advantage if you suddenly have two generations of experience to be passed on. All of this stuff hinges on our capacity and willingness to relate. And this relationship obviously needs some form of ethics, some form of understanding how human beings can be together in reasonable harmony. Because all this is the prerequisite for that transfer of learning, that building of of society's structures that gradually make it possible that babies' brains can develop later, that babies' heads can become bigger, that mothers don't need to primarily have small pelvises so that they can run fast through more of their pregnancy, that they can afford feeling safe enough to actually be fed and protected by a group strong enough, that the gradual involvement of the male in the upbringing of the young, you know, those were all evolutionary feats, which have something to do with civilization, if you want. Good. Let's do some walking meditation. Can we have a bell in half an hour? 4:15. Good.
Thank you.